All right, good morning. Today is Monday, August 10th, 2009. My name is Allison Page and I'm an interviewer with the UW-Madison Oral History Program. And this morning I will be speaking with Kathy Bruner on her experiences and memories of the UW. Kathy, if you want to just maybe start and tell us when and where you were born, some of your childhood memories.
Okay. Give you a little bit of background. My parents met at the University of Wisconsin in the 40s. My mother came here the first year that Liz Waters opened and lived on the all-Jewish floor. And she remembers as her first experience at the UW a picnic on Picnic Point. She came from Massachusetts. She'd been at Wellesley for 2 years and she decided to take a junior year abroad at Wisconsin and she never left. My father came from North Carolina to Milwaukee. To UW-Madison, was in the law school, and developed lots of cooperatives around campus like the Green Lantern. Mm-hmm. So I was born in Madison from parents who met at the UW from different places in the United States. I actually went to nursery school on campus in one of those old buildings that was after the war, one of those just sort of temporary prefab kinds of buildings. Mm-hmm. Then I went to my family lived, I was born actually in the Triangle development on Park Street, where my parents had bought a house with Henry and Virginia Hart. So my mother tells stories of the Triangle and the culture of the Triangle and refugees. And then we moved into the cooperative development of Crestwood when I was a baby. And then at 4, we bought our first farm because my father came from the country and lived on a farm near Verona. So I went to kindergarten and first, second and third grade at Verona, and was best friends with Carol Littleton, who was the daughter of Harvey Littleton, the glassblower. So I spent a lot of time in Harvey's lab out in the country. We moved to our second farm and I went to a one-room school for fourth, fifth, and sixth grades, which was a whole other different experience. And I wasn't getting any arithmetic training. So my parents sent my sister and myself, when we reached seventh grade, to Wisconsin High School, which is the laboratory school at the UW-Madison on Henry Mall. So seventh, eighth, ninth, and tenth, I was on Henry Mall at the UW Lab School of Wisconsin High School, and then it closed and merged with Central High School, and I finished my high school education at Central University High School in 1966. So essentially I started at the UW in nursery school, mm-hmm. and ironically, my career ended up at Ag Hall, which is right next to the UW nursery school, so I feel like I have a chip installed that brings me back to the same place. I went away to college for 2 years to Grinnell and decided I didn't want to stay there and had some sort of difficult formative experiences going to Central America with culture shock, and I needed to take time off. And then I came here to the UW for the rest of my career, floundered around, and my last class to get a degree in history, which I was doing with Stanley Katz in the American History Program, which was piloting some programs on original sources for history, and was fascinating. I needed to take one more science credit. I'd always been afraid of sciences and math. I had trouble with sciences and math. It was Tim Allen's Plants and Man class. And I needed to do a project for it. And I chose control of thistle on the farm and discovered my true vocation, which was land management. And then just started sort of a new journey in horticulture, landscape architecture, native plant management, restoration, that took me to where I am today. Mm-hmm. So the farm experiences, experiences with certain critical individuals on campus, particularly in the Ag School and landscape architecture, and botany, I guess, got me where I am today in large part. So that's a background, I guess, mm-hmm. that provides you what you needed.
Just to go back, did you mention when you were born? What year?
I was born in 1948.
Okay.
Thanksgiving 1948.
Mm-hmm. And it sounds to me, just from what you said about your parents, they were both highly educated.
They were, and highly motivated for social causes. My father was a leader in the cooperative movement in the Madison area, and was in law school with Gaylord Nelson, and the two of them started in politics together. My father was in World War II, and when he and Gaylord came back from the war, they sued the state for redistricting because they said they didn't go to fight a war abroad to come back and lose democracy at home. But that was a lot sparked by the Capital Times and people at the Capital Times. So my parents were part of a generation in Madison that formed the Democratic Party and many progressive causes, and they were friends, for instance, of Carson Gully, who, after whom the building is named over there, and involved a lot of the causes for fair housing in Madison. So yes, I think that's true.
This is maybe just a little bit of an aside, but do you know much about your father's war experience? Did you talk about
My
that
father
much?
Didn't talk about the war experience until just a few years ago. He died of Alzheimer's this last year. And as he got farther into the Alzheimer's, he was willing to talk. And I think it was probably my mother and I have talked about it, post-traumatic stress syndrome prevented him from talking and changed his personality some after the war. But I was just with a friend of mine from Wisconsin High School. And she and I were talking about how she came to dinner one night with my parents a number of years ago, and she talked about her experiences in working with women in pain, the research she was in. And my father all of a sudden started to talk about the war and what had happened to him with injuries and how he hadn't noticed the pain when he was trying to save his men. Mm-hmm. So I also know that from him and a peer of his, that the ROTC program at the university in those days really prepared these men for battle in ways that they think helped them survive, because it was a very special program here in training. And he did train down on Library Mall for the ROTC. Mm-hmm. He was a member of ROTC.
And do you know...
Is this creaking too much?
Oh, no, okay. It's perfectly fine. Do you know much about how your parents met? I know you briefly touched on that.
I think they met at some political gathering.
Mm-hmm.
So my father says he fell in love with my mother because she was carrying a violin, but she denies that. So, but then he was extremely charismatic and leading all sorts of, he started the first interracial rooming house on campus, which is still in existence today. It's the Rochdale International Co-op. They did lots of excursions, athletic things together.
You mentioned your parents living in the Triangle.
The Triangle redevelopment is the, it's at the corner of Park and, well, we lived, our house was on Chandler Street. It was the last one to be torn down for the Triangle redevelopment. And when I was doing a little presentation about my father's life at the Alzheimer's unit a few years ago, it turned out there were two women there, both of almost 100. One of them African-American, one of them Italian, who remembered the Triangle very well, and they were still acute enough in their memory to be able to describe how it was three communities that lived together in peace. Mm-hmm. They each had their separate community, but they all got along very well. So mm-hmm. it was a tragedy for Madison that was torn apart.
Mm-hmm.
I went to to Central High School. I went with most of the kids from that neighborhood for my mm-hmm. last 2 years of high school.
You mentioned refugees. Refugees from where?
There were Jewish refugees in the Triangle from the war. In particular, a man, I'm trying to think of his, I can't think of his name, but he was a lawyer in Germany, and he drove a taxi when he was in this country. So it was refugees. And then one of the people who was a chair of the early Democratic Party and a close friend of the family was Liesl Tarko. And she was a refugee from Austria. And then her husband, I think I've mentioned to you about, is Harold Tarko, who was a friend of Harry Weissman's in Milwaukee. They grew up together. But Liesl Tarko was another refugee who was a close friend of the family.
Mm-hmm.
And Hanya Reese was another refugee. She was our pediatrician. So my parents had friends who were refugees that they tried to help out.
Mm-hmm. Did you grow up in a Jewish community, would you say?
I did not. My father was a Methodist and my mother was Jewish, but they chose not to practice. Mm-hmm. Actually, I grew up thinking there were no Jews in Wisconsin and the East Coast was nothing but Jewish because we would go back every summer to visit all the relatives and everybody there was Jewish.
Mm-hmm.
So, no, I wasn't raised in the tradition.
Mm-hmm.
We had Jewish friends who came to Christmas every year so that we could all have Christmas, but it was a non-religious Christmas for everybody. So, no, I did not really grow up in the Jewish tradition. Both my siblings have married back into Jewish families, though, and my brother is raising his family in the Jewish tradition.
Talk a little bit about your siblings. You mentioned you have two.
I do. I have a younger brother. He's 5 years younger than I am, lives on the West Coast, and I have an older sister who's on the East Coast. She's the director of pediatric obesity for the National Institutes of Health, so she's a doctor. My brother's in financial consulting. He and I were very close growing up on the farm. He did a lot of the farming in the early years before he left. After my sister had left, he and I were at the farm together doing a lot of the farming.
Mm-hmm.
The farm experience was absolutely critical for how I turned out today because we were so involved in nature. My father was always bringing home animals. One goat, one sheep, one, you know, in the Willie's Jeep was always coming home with another animal. So, but we had an operating sheep farm at the first farm. And one of my early memories, which is very difficult, is when hoof and mouth disease struck the area and we had to burn the whole flock. I still remember the smell of the sheep burning. At the second farm, we raised beef. And I showed calves and 4-H. Or the calf showed me because it was never trained well enough when we got there. So I was a member of the 4-H club. And a couple of the people who helped me in 4-H were Olive and John Thompson from the botany department, helped me with my first plant collection and that sort of thing. So, yeah, I had the Wisconsin 4-H experience. It was difficult because everybody else in the club was dairy. So, but one of the interesting things there is I guess I learned one of my first values or special qualities as a human being was used to have long talks with the man across the road who had sold us our beef herd. He used to come over to talk, and we would talk for a long time. And I hadn't really realized that I was just interested in talking to people until then. So that was an interesting experience.
Do you have any particularly strong memories of your childhood?
I think the ones which are strongest have to do with when I was a small child at the farm, playing house under a pine tree. That's the kind of thing which sticks with me that I think I try to recreate for children today in what I do. And probably the strongest thing also is just the sense that we were raised with a division between what's nature and what's us, that we are really part of the natural world,
mm-hmm.
and animals are part of the natural world. We went through painful things and exhilarating things when we're saving lambs and saving calves, and you don't always save them, and we lose them. And watching animals suffer, but helping animals. So that line between what's human and what's not human gets blurred, and that's something which is one of my guiding goals for what I do is to help children realize that they're not separate from the world, that kind of world. So that's been one of the influences on me.
Returning to kind of the progression of your education, was it difficult, do you think, for you moving from Wisconsin High School on UW campus to emerging with Central?
It was very difficult. I think my whole class was sort of disoriented, and we had our first reunion about 3 years ago. Basically, we were sophomores in high school the last time we saw each other, And it was really interesting to get together with people in their late 50s and talk about life and what it meant to us. We split up between Central and West, pretty much, and to talk about those experiences. So, yeah, it was the other thing which made it difficult for me is that my father was the juvenile judge, and many of the people at Central were juvenile delinquents. So my classmates were going to see my father in court. So that was a particular challenge. Mm-hmm. At that time, I also became more involved, particularly in the summer, in getting involved in working on projects that had to do with things like Head Start. My father started the first Head Start in Madison, and I worked in that. So that developed my sensibility of working with those kinds of people, and something I've struggled with all the time is issues of who's different and issues of class and poverty and all very difficult things. But that was one of my first exposures myself personally to getting immersed in those kinds of things. Growing up on a farm, you're really kind of separate from it.
Could you talk a little bit more about the Head Start program? I'm not quite familiar with that.
The Head Start program, actually I'm trying to remember if that was part of the War on Poverty. But the idea was to try to provide children before they're ready for kindergarten with some kind of environment to help them learn and get acclimated and give them some support. And my father at the same time had started a program for trying to teach women to be mothers by making them assistant teachers, but they were really learning themselves how to be mothers and how to be attentive. Mm-hmm. But it was part of the whole culture of late 60s, early 70s, where you're really trying to help people and have a great society, something which we clearly went away from in later years, but that's what was going on then, and my parents were involved in that.
And in what way did you contribute? How did you?
I was just helping with in the classroom, and then later when I was in college and starting my own adventure and program in this, I actually worked in the Montessori school, working with children in landscape, so that was probably my next encounter with kids that age. So, but I haven't had much encounter otherwise with children, little children in the classroom.
Did you have any close relationships with friends in high school? I know it must have been difficult with changing schools and everything, but did you have any?
I had a few friends that I hung out with. They were primarily from the village of Sherwood Hills. Most of the kids at Wisconsin High School were from the village of Sherwood Hills or Maple Bluff, because those two communities did not have their own high school. There were a few people who, in retrospect, when I look back and I see they were there, were considered from the poor side of the tracks, and I think they must have felt it. But I've always been kind of a loner. My sister was the belle of the ball for everything, you know, the sophomore who was the junior prom queen. She was the varsity cheerleader and I was the junior varsity cheerleader. So I was always being compared to my older sister. So I developed, she was kind of the science math person, I developed the artistic personality and went my own direction and was really more of a tomboy, mm-hmm. and on the farm a lot, mm-hmm. playing with my brother and nature while she was out doing things more with people. So I'm less the social person and more of a loner and an artsy person. But that's the way I thought of myself in any case.
Well, that's very interesting, since you ended up obviously in a career that's very scientific based.
And that's actually a really interesting combination. When I look, I found an old sketchbook quite a few years ago from Wisconsin High School, where our wonderful art teacher, Larry Everard, who I just saw again the other day, had written a comment on my sketchbook that I should think about design and landscape architecture as a field. And I apparently didn't know what it was, because I didn't take any note of it. And if I had followed his advice early on, I wouldn't have wandered around for so long. Mm-hmm. So my art interest is really in the interpretation of landscape. And the two have come together, sort of the human spirit and landscape, I think, is where it ended up. So I found my way there, but it's been a stumbling the whole way. So the science is really just in the service of that, mm-hmm. I think. any place where I've really had to do science per se and math has been really hard for me. When I have to have it in some kind of visual context of a process. And similarly, teachers at the university who have insisted on sort of a hardcore science perception, I haven't done very well with them, as opposed to people who were inspired by greater aspirations, I think, for what it's all for. I've really been much, much better at mentoring me.
And when did you finish high school?
I graduated in 1966. And that's when classmates went off to the Vietnam War or to Canada or so. My brother-in-law was here at that. My sister came back to the university too for 2 years, and there's when she met her husband, who was a graduate student in history under Taylor, which it was a pretty left-leaning group. And he and others taught high school students about Marx in the evening, so I went to classes on Karl Marx in the evening. So that was I was getting radicalized at an early age.
Well, having gone to high school during the 60s, and given your parents' political background, were you politically aware during the 60s?
We were a family that did not have a TV set intentionally, except for political conventions. So political conventions and the Democratic Party were the center of life around which everything else revolved. So I have very clear images of the Adlai Stevenson campaign, Hubert Humphrey. I had my picture in the paper shaking hands with Hubert Humphrey with a torn winter farm coat on, demonstrating that he shook the hand of people who were poor. We drove around in caravans, you know, with the car top signs on, campaigning for presidents and that kind of. So the Democratic Party was a big part of my parents' life.
Mm-hmm.
We had the donkey that was taken to the Democratic Party events, and we named her Carrie Liesel. Liesel for Liesel Tarko and Carrie Lee for Carrie Lee Nelson. So I was politically aware in the sense of believing in progressive causes and being very aware of inequities in society. It was a difficult time, though, because it was one of those disconnects where, because we were privileged and affluent compared to all these other people, I think as a child and as an adolescent, our parents didn't necessarily recognize that we too needed support, and that just because we had that kind of affluence doesn't mean that we couldn't have unhappy times and things. And that was a big influence on our childhood. We were sort of, on the farm, we were like a work group, a labor group assigned for things to get done, and everything was very organized and administered. It wasn't a free-for-all. Everything was very efficient at the farm, and it was all about work and the work ethic. Other people came out to play to use the farm when we were all supposed to be working. I think that's my siblings and I are all really driven to get things done,
mm-hmm.
personally or whatever. But you know, nobody lazes. Nobody takes it easy.
And you're still that way?
We're all that way.
Yeah.
Not necessarily always to our best good. Mm-hmm. Not necessarily to our, I guess. There are better ways to live than working all the time, put it that way.
Mm-hmm. Just briefly, going back to that previous question that I asked about the 60s, you're fairly quite young, actually, in the 60s, going through high school at the time. Do you have any memories of John F. Kennedy, Robert Kennedy,
Martin
Luther King?
Oh, I'm glad you asked. So I remember very clearly where I was when John F. Kennedy was shot. I was a junior varsity cheerleader over at Wisconsin High School, and we had just had a pep rally where we performed, and we were allowed to go over to Rennebaum's, which is across the street on University Avenue, right after a pep rally. So I and the three other girls, I guess we were girls at that stage who were cheerleaders, were sitting together when the announcement came in, and it was absolutely devastating. We were inconsolable, or I was inconsolable for a long time. I remember standing in the hall of Wisconsin High, feeling absolutely devastated by what we had learned. Mm-hmm. So yeah, that was a big deal.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, it was very much affected. I think that's my strongest memory of the 60s.
Mm-hmm.
There were all sorts of little ditties and stuff that people would say about Nixon too, and you know, little things like that that went around. But I think the death of Kennedy was the biggest thing for sure.
Do you have any memories of how your parents reacted, obviously given their political interests?
Everybody was glued to the TV set for days. We did have a TV then. I can remember it profoundly, being in the living room and all of us watching Jackie and the kids and the whole caravan, every second of it. Yeah, we were just glued to the TV set. It was some kind of this huge catharsis that everybody was going through.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, it was a very painful time. And then the Bobby Kennedy, and then Martin Luther King. So all of that, I do remember.
Mm-hmm.
The other thing which was different about me, I guess, in high school, is that I was the I was the only white member of the youth NAACP. My parents are part of the NAACP, and I joined, and I was secretary. And so I had some really interesting experiences because we traveled by school bus to Ohio with Father Greppi, who was a priest from Milwaukee, during all of the desegregation battles. And I told him that I wanted to go to the South, and he told me that just wasn't the right thing for me at that point. But so I traveled around with kids from the NAACP, learned to dance in Beloit. So that was a very interesting cultural experience, including, now I can't say his name, but he was I'll have to think of it later, the man who worked hard in affirmative action in Madison and died just a couple of years ago, went to Central High School as well. He was about 3 years older than I was, and he was the first one to tell me about Black Power, and I was horrified at that time. But then when I went away to college, my roommate, I ended up with an African-American roommate, physicist, and she took me to Black Power events in Iowa. So I was her white friend, and she took me to the Black Power events.
Mm-hmm.
So that was a really wonderful experience to be included that way and part of it, so I understood it a lot better.
What kind of impressions did you have of Father Greppi?
He was a gentle, strong human being. I just remember him as slight, willowy, quiet, and clearly a lot more aware of my weaknesses than I was. So you know, could tell me that no, this is not the right thing for you.
Mm-hmm.
But the kids just. We were kids then. We just followed him. He was wonderful as far as we were concerned, fighting for justice.
And you had the support of your parents?
I guess I did. They allowed me to go on a bus all the way to Ohio, which then broke down. So it took us days to get back. And I think because they had been involved with the people and they knew the families. So yes, I did have their support. One of my heroes, I guess, in life, too, is Mary Hunter, who died several years ago. She and John Patrick Hunter were leaders of the NAACP, too, and she was sort of a guiding spirit of mine at these NAACP events. So if Mary Hunter was involved, I thought the NAACP was would be a good thing.
What kind of things did you do when you went on some of these rallies, down to Ohio, for example?
I actually don't have very strong memories of it. We must have been protesting. It's about all I just remember riding back and forth on the bus and meeting people and how different it was and feeling very naive, I think, is
mm-hmm.
mostly what I remember. And it was just kind of a bizarre experience, so I don't remember too much of the detail. And I expect I was in it just because I thought it was the right thing to do. I mean, who I turned out to be is not necessarily that, but that was what I was brought up to be, that kind of person, and so I did it. But it was probably one of my first experiences of really being different You know, I know what it's like to be the one person who isn't the same in the group. Because mm-hmm. that has lasted. I seem to put myself in situations where I'm kind of fighting the current. I'm not the same, and I'm perceived as different. So getting comfortable with difference and still feeling strong.
Mm-hmm.
It probably started then, and trying to really learn about other people, and not be scared, and not be hurt, but learn from them. I think it probably. And actually, even in the one-room school, we had some of those experiences because we're with country kids, and it was kind of a joke that my mother's a quarter Russian and I'm half Jewish, and that was during the, you know, communist times. Oh, those two people, they're Russian and they're Jews, you know. Ooh. So that was already were pointed out as different and not part of the farm community either.
Oh, really?
So, because we didn't grow up on Wisconsin farms, it was... My parents were people with jobs in town who were farming. So that makes you different. We're not dairy farmers trying to grovel out a living where it's really, really hard. This is by choice. We don't have to live on a farm. Mm-hmm. So we're different.
Did you ever experience any negative reaction from other people because of that?
I think in general I've never belonged. I don't think there's any group to which I have really wholly belonged. We were set aside from the beginning in different ways. Yeah. So it's children can be cruel. I don't remember the cruelty there, but I do remember feeling that I didn't belong. And part of that is just personality, and I'm a loner type.
Mm-hmm.
And so, to sense, maybe I choose not to belong.
Did you feel a sense of belonging when you were involved in the NAACP?
I did, in a sense, actually. Yeah, I did. I felt accepted.
Mm-hmm.
I felt accepted, and I think it was partly multi-generational, because this was something where you were also with adults sometimes and appreciated. I didn't feel like people were rejecting me. Is sort of peculiar when you think back on it.
Mm-hmm.
Maybe I just wasn't aware of it. These are interesting questions, though, because I think that they do lead to experiences later of why I'm willing to put up with situations where I don't belong.
Mm-hmm. Well, that's kind of a good segue to continue our conversation. So you're done with high school in 1966. What are your feelings about education and career at that point, do you think?
I wanted to be, I think, a writer or an artist, but I didn't really know. I had the feeling that I always said I wanted to be a nurse or writer or an artist. That was kind of what girls said. I clearly didn't have any aspirations or thoughts at that time of anything to do with the sciences or nature. I think I was really going in the direction of art if I could.
Mm-hmm.
And then I went to Grinnell, and I wasn't ready. And I was really cut off from my family. They just kind of, there wasn't a connection there. And I had a very difficult time my first semester with who I'd been assigned as a roommate. It was a Jewish woman from, a girl I guess still at that point in the way people talked, from Ohio, who totally dominated everything, and it was just too much for me. So I asked to move in second semesters when I was assigned to a floor that had mostly seniors, and here comes a freshman, and they were radical seniors. And then I put my Ho Chi Minh poster up on the door, and they realized that I was going to be the one that carried the torch after they left. So I became one of them, sort of one of the radicals on campus. And what I remember is that this roommate was always playing Miles Davis, and it made me sick to my stomach because I had never experienced jazz. Now I have a greater appreciation for jazz, but that was a cultural change that was I had to get used to. She was a lovely person. I lost track of her, and then I found that she had died, and it's just one of the losses that I have that I didn't keep up with her. But After my first year at college, I was either going to go to a kibbutz in Israel or to South America to a, or Central America to a Unitarian Universalist program. And then the war broke out between the Palestinians and the Israelis, and all nobody was able to travel there. And so I went to Honduras with no training, no preparation, joined some people from the Peace Corps, and we worked with mental patients that we took to the mountains to raise food for the mental patients in the town. And that's probably the most formative experience of my whole life, because with no preparation, I was thrown into these abject poverty situation, and right up close with all these human beings, and I gave shots to help with malnutrition, and it's the most transformative experience I've ever had, and I'll never regret it. But it threw me. I was just a wreck for 2 or 3 years after that, or at least a year. Year and a half after that, I just couldn't work when I came back to school, because there was no debriefing either. So I spent a summer with these people, and my family, because my father's kind of nuts, decided to bring the rest of the family down to go trekking the coast of Honduras where white people had never been. And they came and camped in the middle of they came and camped in the middle of our hospital, which is the bizarrest thing what they saw, or was described to me later, is me taking off in the morning with all these mental patients with all of our tools over our shoulders, and me just leading all these men off to work to raise cabbages and things. And I guess in retrospect, that's the way it's been the rest of my life. So, but I think that was the first time that it was really my experience of working with, and not just trying to do what somebody else thought I should be doing. And I guess it's just the biggest influence, because you see what the world really is like and what we have in comparison.
Mm-hmm.
So that's probably been the biggest thing which affected what I've done the rest of my life.
Mm-hmm. Did you make any close relationships with anyone down there?
I did have a friendship for a while with a woman who was in that with me, and we got together a couple times. We lived in different parts of the country, went to see her. But we didn't really have that much affinity for each other. We weren't very much alike. Then there were two men who were conscientious objectors who were leading it, and I had my first male relationship in that setting, and that was traumatic, because it was more of a protective relationship to protect me from assault by men in the community.
Mm.
So it was sort of a bonding together to take care of each other and to protect each other. But I was extremely naive when that happened, so it was a very rude awakening to the facts of life in that environment. There was also a woman in the pensión in Tegucigalpa whom I met and confided in, who told me that I needed to keep quiet and not say the things I was doing because it was too dangerous, because I was saying things politically. And she was part of the Peace Corps, and she told me it was too dangerous for me to say the things that I was saying. So again, it was a running up against reality. You know, you can say all these things, but when you're in an environment where it's not safe, it's a wake-up call. Many, many years later, she was at independent living in the retirement home where my aunt was. And so we visited again. Mm-hmm. And she had also actually been from the original Italian neighborhood in Madison. So it was a peculiar cycling through of things, but
mm-hmm.
so I met her again.
And you were down in Honduras only one summer?
That's right, it was 3 months.
Mm-hmm.
That's right, it was a summer, and then I went back to school. That's when I think I started also going to some of the Black Power rallies somewhere in there with my friend Iowa. The Vietnam War and Dow happened around that time while I was away. So the Dow event here, which my sister is in the Dow demonstration. Anyhow, I I got very involved in my Spanish literature classes and kind of went over the edge during that and had a personal crisis and had to leave and put off my final exams and come back here and took my final exams later.
Mm-hmm.
And one of the men who was a professor there was Bob Haven, economics. He was one of them, kept challenging me as one of the radicals on campus. He also came to the UW at that time, and then I took my final exam from him here.
Mm-hmm.
He came to the Institutes on Poverty here. So Grinnell was really a formative experience from the, I think, the friendship, and because of, that was the time when I went off on my own to do something.
Mm-hmm. And Grinnell's located?
In Iowa.
In Iowa, okay.
Mm-hmm.
And you were there only 1 year?
2 years.
Two years.
Okay.
And so you come back from Honduras, and do you go back to Grinnell, or do you go to the UW?
I went back to Grinnell for basically a whole year. But I was really having trouble. And then
mm-hmm.
I came here. And then I came here to
mm-hmm.
kind of fall apart, get together, go
mm-hmm.
through adolescent crises, identity crises, that kind of thing.
Mm-hmm.
Yes.
What was the hardest part about coming back from Honduras? Because you talk about that being extremely difficult. In what ways?
What I have in my notebooks and sketchbooks at that time are just sort of repetitive phrases that clearly show that I was in shock at the condition of humans. The hospital in Tegucigalpa, the only psychiatrist was somebody who admitted patients, and the patients were on the floor, and some of them were in chains. And then in the country, what we found, the patients, a lot of them, there really wasn't a psychological condition, it was malnutrition. And so we would inject them with vitamin B12, and people who were catatonic would start to come out of their catatonia.
Mm-hmm.
So the malnutrition. And then I formed relationships with the people in the community where the hospital was.
Mm-hmm.
You know, you got to know the people, and you know, it was just wonderful to, they were real people, you know, and the language barrier. The being illiterate, it wasn't the same as Spanish that you would get like in a Spanish class.
Mm-hmm.
A lot of it is body language, and so it was a hard Spanish to pick up, but we really learned to communicate.
Mm-hmm.
And to be able to learn to communicate across all those divides was really meaningful.
Mm-hmm.
And we did. I formed close. It wasn't something you could keep up once you left.
Mm-hmm.
So I'm sure all those people are dead and gone. The average, you know, then the hurricanes and everything else, I'm sure those people have never survived.
Mm-hmm. I guess perhaps moving on, so you come back from Honduras, you go to Grinnell for about a year. What made you decide to come to the UW?
Well, it was coming home in my psychological state. I needed to come here. And I needed to finish my degree. So I re-enrolled here. I was getting psychological counseling at that time. I got a job working in the reserve room of the Memorial Library. Didn't pay very much. And then I had a job also at the Historical Society at the checkout desk. And that's where I read Daniel Deronda. And that was a real personal revelation to me, sort of discovering your Jewish roots through Daniel Deronda. So I really got into George Eliot in my classes here. But I struggled in classes and trying to figure out what I was going to do. I ended up rooming with a woman from Boston. And she and I became good friends, and we lived in an apartment that my sister had lived in before, so we kind of handed that on as a tradition. And then it was, I guess before then, though, I lived in a house over on Wilson Street with the daughter of another psychiatrist in town, and she and I and her sister decided to go to Mexico to the language school in Cuernavaca. So I took a trip out to the West Coast to see a friend from Grinnell. It turned out he was the son of William Stafford, the poet. And then I worked my way down the California coastline, and I and these other people, and there's lots of little stories along the way, went to Mexico and lived with lived with families, and went to Cuernavaca language school. And then I traveled with a Mexican for a while in Mexico before I came back. Mm-hmm. And then that next year was, I became extremely ill, and that was a crisis in my life. I had, in my thrashing around as adolescents do, and it was a promiscuous time, I'd gotten together with a man just back from Vietnam for a night, who was carrying one of the new new strains, and I became extremely ill. They didn't know what was wrong with me, and in the figuring it out, they almost killed me. But I almost died of an infection. And so you face. I could tell that things were. So you face your mortality at that point. I think that was also a really important life-changing experience, is that you know that you might not come out of it, mm-hmm. going into surgery, that might be it. So that was but I did come out of it, went through difficult times with my family, and then I guess I moved in with this friend, and we were in the history courses together. And then we had the TAA strike and the protests against the war all came together, the protest against Cambodia. And that's when I met my future husband, still my husband. He and I were picketing together on the lakeshore path by the natatorium, which was then a one-way road going out, and we were preventing trucks from coming in with supplies to campus, and he was one of the TAs who was a case for the TAA strike. And I was an undergraduate supporting the TAA strike. Mm-hmm. And that's where I met him, on the graveyard shift during the night. And we both became part of something called the Labor Committee on campus, which was a left group working to fight the war and to support the TA union. And we had picnics and meetings, and this woman named Jackie, I wish I could remember her name, was a very outspoken person during that time leading the labor committee fight on campus. And a couple of graduate students who've been friends of my sister's, I was very close to, Susan Gutwill and Alan Kaufman, were also big leaders in that, and they were in social work, sociology, which was a very radical department at that time. Sociology, English, and history. And then over the next couple of years, those departments were purged to get rid of outside agitators, including faculty who had been leading the leftist struggle on campus. So, but I was one of those students running in the face of tear gas and looking up at the humanities building with all the National Guard patrolling on the cement walls. Was a rather peculiar time. And where we lived, the helicopters were always going over, and surveillance. It was a pretty peculiar time. Mm-hmm. There was one demonstration after another. It's when I was so sick that the Black Studies Department protests were happening, so I wasn't mm-hmm. on campus when they were establishing the Black Studies Department, but the campus was also shut down during all those demonstrations. Mm-hmm. So it was a different time. It was clearly a different time.
Do you recall hearing about Black Thursday at UW Oshkosh, the black students?
I don't remember that. I remember that the Kent State stuff was going on at the same time we were, but I don't remember. And if that was at the same time, I think, as our Black Studies protests, I was too out of it, I think, mm-hmm. with my illness to have been tracking what was going on then.
How long were you ill?
Probably, I was in the hospital for a week and then laid up at my parents' place for like a month or mm-hmm. 5 weeks or something like that.
How did you get involved with the TAA strike?
I don't remember initially what it was, but I think because I was going to classes and traveling with a group of people who were fairly left, because that was just my sister and brother-in-law had brought me along on that track. We were all aware of that, and there were meetings that you sign up as an undergraduate to go and support the TAA strike. And so I signed up to demonstrate and to be on the picket line. We protested in front of Bascom, and I think I was just part of the crowd that was doing that.
Mm-hmm.
And I wore army fatigues all the time. Dressed in khaki from, we're always going down and getting our clothes from the Army Navy store on Henry Street. The other thing that was going on during that time was women's consciousness raising groups. And I and a couple of friends, Anna Lombroso and Adrian Kamsler, and Susan Gutwill, who's the other person I talked to, we had those kinds of conversations and talks about feminism and consciousness raising.
Mm-hmm.
And it was the same time that I was reading George Eliot and taking another class in the English department. I guess it was part of a class on just women writers, and so I was getting my first introduction to a feminine consciousness or whatever, and that kind of liberation. Betty Friedan was coming to campus. Adrian Rich came to speak. So, but there was, we're getting introduced to all these famous people at the same time. And that was very important, I think.
Did you go and listen to any of these?
Well, I did.
Yeah.
I did, yeah. I remember Adrian Rich very clearly. And Margaret Piercy? Marge Piercy? So poets. I remember going to hear poets. Women poets. And then it was in 19... So I guess if I jump ahead here, I limped through my history work, and then I took the Plants and Man class and started this whole new interest in plants. I had been struggling in the art department too, and I still wanted to do art, but it was a very competitive, cold world. I didn't think I was good enough, and I didn't like that kind of world. So I knew that art still had to be part of my life somehow, but that wasn't the way, and I wasn't good enough for that world. So when the plant thing came along, I instantly recognized it as more me, and then started a search to try to figure out how to do it. And there wasn't a way to do it the way I wanted to do it.
Mm-hmm.
So I had to piece together my own program. It just didn't exist.
Mm-hmm.
So I started in horticulture, a bachelor's. And that's where, I guess, something I really did want to record is there were no women in the horticulture department in those days. There were probably three of us taking classes. It was all breeding and vegetable and fruit oriented, definitely just crop industry. And those of us who were coming into the women coming in there were interested in things like people relating to plants, and it was sort of the back to earth movement. And it was very strange being in a class. It was all men. And it was okay in those days for the instructors to wear like ties with a pin-up or pencils with pin-ups on them, or it was that kind of environment. That was okay. It was acceptable. And somehow my husband and I were working at my parents' farm, and there was a woman who was one of the first women. Well, she was a graduate student in the botany department under Cottam, and she was writing a interpretation of Curtis Prairie for the Arboretum, and I had not been involved in the Arboretum at all except to go and just enjoy being in the Arboretum. But she started collecting things, saving plants. What she had done is she'd answered an ad of my parents at the Whole Earth Co-op on Johnson Street for free garden space. So she'd come out and she started gardening at the farm, and then she kind of moved in with us. And we ended up, as part of our farm work, totally removing all the quack grass and weeds from the sandy hill and planting a prairie.
Oh.
That was before I was interested in prairie. I didn't know anything about prairie.
Mm.
and we were planting things that Binda Reich and Grant Cottom were saving from roadsides around Wisconsin. So it was our first prairie restoration, what I was called the Binda's Prairie. So Binda Reich. So that was my first introduction to somebody who was making a profession out of the plant world and prairie. So I learned, then I got involved after that in prairies, and then I was able to start a career of trying to learn native restoration for horticulture. And I met Daryl Morrison, or it was through all that that I got involved. Daryl Morrison, who was the chair of landscape architecture and the one who started the whole prairie restoration program at the university in landscape architecture. And he'd learned it from people in Iowa. But he had was starting a project out that's insurance company with a vice president of the insurance company, which was CUNA Mutual, who at that time it was a very grassroots philosophy, like a co-op. And this doctor, who was a vice president, had come to Daryl and said he wanted to do an innovative landscape because the company was still sort of in the country, and he wanted to bury the cars underground, mm-hmm. wanted to make it look part of the. So Daryl designed a landscape of prairie over parking decks and asked if I would go out there and work with the maintenance department to make it work. So that's where it all started, that I went out to work at CUNA Mutual as a student for them. And that's where the whole world started of my battling against a women's status mm-hmm. in the world. It was okay in those days to say, you just don't want a girl. And they tried to frighten me away and did all sorts of things to try to sort of destroy me, but that's where I learned of how to prove myself. Mm-hmm. But that went on for many, many, many years in many forms and scenarios out there proving myself. And to be quite frank, it hasn't changed anywhere. but that's where I ended up with the other thing is that then, and it's still connected to the university, that scenario, because we set it up so that then Daryl and Evelyn Howell, who would come into the LA department the same year that around that time, brought their classes out and used the prairie as an educational mm-hmm. program. And then Sam Harper, who had been the vice president who got me going, made it possible for me to start working with local schools and going to the school sites and having the schools come to the prairie. And then people like Chuck Koval, who just died in the last week, an entomologist, would come and help me with high school students to do projects in the prairie. So in a sense, it was like having an off-site research project. Mm-hmm. And it was extremely combative with the landscape community in Madison. And so there were a group of us who worked to get natural landscapes accepted in Madison. And it was headline stuff. I mean, it was just amazing how threatened people were by tall grass. Just amazing how they would fight. So that kind of, I guess, gets you up to how I ended up where I went. Mm-hmm. connect the dots.
Yep, exactly.
That company, because of all the political infighting and the desire to expand, ended up destroying the Prairie Project. But because of my support on the inside from the comptroller who respected what I could do, and all sorts of other people in the management of the landscape who were not professional and not able to handle things appropriately, I was put in charge of all of that, over all the landscaping anyhow, mm-hmm. and then just worked on it more as an urban landscape and urban forestry program. Mm-hmm. But the company merged with other non-union companies and decided to outsource all of the facilities management in 1995, which is all of a sudden I was unemployed. And I went into business with a woman who I had met a few years before that, who had been the arborist for New York City and Central Park, and had come here after her husband died to get another degree in geography. And she and I started a business together called Midwest Land and Culture. But that clearly wasn't going to give us the financial wherewithal and benefits that I needed, and that's when I ended up situation came up here. Virginia Klein was the ecologist at the Arboretum, and she had finished a management plan for what was called Campus Natural Areas. And she and a wonderful woman named Harriet Irwin was a naturalist, and Evelyn Howell and I had used to take walks on a regular basis to talk and review things about the ecology of the Arboretum. And so she had her eye on me as the one to take over to try to implement what she had wanted to do with the Campus Natural Areas. So when Greg Armstrong found some grant money to start that through the Brittingham Foundation and a gift from Walter Frauci, I applied for that position, and Jenna really badly wanted me to have it. And I had been volunteering for years by then with Ed Hasselkus, who's just a wonderful man, at the Arboretum, mm-hmm. when I was getting really involved in arboriculture. So I've been volunteering for him for 10 or 12 years. So I was a known quantity at the Arboretum for all sorts of reasons in any case, and I've been working with people. So that's how that whole thing happened that I ended up. It was a part-time job for a few months, but I worked so hard full-time while I was also doing my other business that another wonderful person named Gary Beck was the assistant director of physical plant, and he convinced John Herod, who's director of physical plant, to put me on half-time. So that then I became half-time for the physical plant as well as half-time under the Arboretum. And then eventually, through all sorts of political changes that happened with the preserve, which is also because of the way I do things versus the way others do things, I ended up eventually full-time under the physical plant. Mm. So Gary Beck is probably the best supervisor I've ever had. He retired in 2000. He had been captain of the nuclear aircraft carrier, the Eisenhower. And then was head of ROTC here, Army ROTC. There had been a little incident at the Eisenhower just before he was done with his, it had nothing to do with him really, but whenever anything happens to anything like that, the captain mm-hmm. is affected. So he came here to run the Army ROTC, and Donna Shalala asked him to reorganize physical plant. So he was over there. And so he's somebody who was so used to being in charge of so many people that he was not a micromanager, and he knew how to manage people, and he was just a wonderful, wonderful supervisor. But that's how I really got into the mm-hmm. to a regular job here.
I might just want to, well, first of all, I should check on the time and see how you're doing.
I'm okay. It's up to you,
okay.
Yes.
Because we can always resume our conversation
sure.
some other time. If,
sure.
You know, depending on what your schedule looks like. But maybe it might be beneficial just to go back through some of the
sure,
because
I've just been rambling here, so now you can tell me where you're at.
But
wanting to just sort of get the chronology all in there.
Yeah. So when you're at the UW, you're still working on your history BA?
Mm-hmm.
You didn't graduate from Grinnell?
Correct.
Correct, okay.
I got a bachelor's in history here,
okay.
1972.
And so while you're doing your undergrad, you take that history plans and management class. What was it about that particular class that you really enjoyed that kind of sparked this interest in you that you didn't even seem to have known?
What Tim Allen did was go through the history of plants and how they affect humans. It's like the potato famine or just food crops, so that you see the real connection between food and humans. And I guess I was just really excited by that that relationship between the natural world and humans. It was like putting culture and nature together for the first time.
Mm-hmm.
The whole history of the potato famine effect, that, I mean, right here in this building is where they solved the potato famine.
Mm-hmm.
You know, that was just amazing stuff.
In terms of your undergraduate studies, was that towards the end of your coursework for your BA?
Yes, the plants and man class was the last class I needed to take to graduate. And it told me that I needed to start all over.
Now, so did you work for CUNA after you had graduated from your BA, and then where does that fit in with your...
I started a second bachelor's in horticulture and went to work for CUNA Mutual at the same time. And then when I started working with the school system, the school said they preferred I'd be getting a master's, and I switched to a master's program in horticulture. And they were really wonderful in horticulture. They had the option of, instead of writing a thesis, you could take more courses. And given all the things which I wanted to combine from various different subject matters for what I was doing, I had the option of taking more courses, and that was really great.
Mm-hmm.
So I had Brent McCown, Mac Dana, and Daryl Morrison were on my committee. Mac Dana was my major advisor, but all those people were really good.
And what's the time frame in terms of when you started your second BA/MA program?
Mm-hmm. Well, I got my BA in 72, and I was at CUNA Mutual by 73. So I guess it was... They were one followed right after the other.
Mm-hmm.
I went right into the next phase of things. And I was sort of part-time, like in the summer, at CUNA Mutual.
Mm-hmm.
And then actually there was a break, and I was trying to get a job somewhere else, and I remember trying to get a job at a nursery, and they wouldn't take me because I was a girl.
Mm-hmm.
And they said I wasn't strong enough.
Mm-hmm.
And I remember saying, I was born with a shovel in my hand.
That's a very good lead-in for actually a question that I've been kind of thinking about asking here for a bit now. You talked about some of the struggles that you've had, specifically when you worked for CUNA, battling feminism, sexism. Where do you think you got that strength to continue to fight this sort of thing?
That's really a good question. I think one of the human beings that I met at that time, who was my immediate supervisor, was just a wonderful person. His name was Art Dish, and he just died a couple years ago. No college education, just a really good human being, very sensitive human being. And he was old school, that you do things right and you respect humans. And he and I hit it off right away with a lot of mutual respect. And I knew I was doing the right thing, and I knew I had his respect, and I knew I could get the respect of the people I was working with. So when I was dealing with the issues of people above us, somehow knowing I was grounded in knowing I was doing the right thing, and my values were very strong because I was coming out there having discovered my mission in life,
mm-hmm.
and excited about it, and then to connect with these other human beings who also could see that it was really cool even though it was really hard.
Mm-hmm.
And he in particular was willing to take a lot of abuse from above to stand beside me.
Mm-hmm.
And so somehow, I guess I just took a stand that I knew it was the right thing, and I knew these people were wrong. I'll give you, and it was difficult for other people too to have a woman there. There was an African-American man on the crew that summer who had been on the inside, and he really wanted to have more of an office job. And he didn't like the idea of having to work in this kind of industry. But it would also be, he was also trying to fight for a place. I mean, there may be two African Americans at CUNA Mutual, and he was one of them. And CUNA Mutual is all glass. And so you see people, what we're doing outside.
Mm-hmm.
The first day of work, I remember so clearly, we had to struggle over who was going to push the wheelbarrow coming out of the parking ramp where we're all going to be visible.
Mm-hmm.
He and I ended up, each of us holding one handle of the wheelbarrow. That's always been a symbol to me. You know, you work it out.
Mm-hmm.
We pushed the wheelbarrow out together because he wasn't going to let the girl do it, and I wasn't going to be cowed. You know, so it was. Anyhow, that was. I knew that those of us who were working together were a team, and could be a team at that time. It wasn't always so, But this group, I felt comfortable that I was doing the right thing,
mm-hmm.
so I could stand up. And I had the person who had brought me out there was behind me.
Mm-hmm.
There were politics above me where he didn't get along with other people, and so I, to a certain extent, I was the pawn of
mm-hmm.
struggles of other people. So it was complex,
mm-hmm.
but because people don't like being told what to do by somebody else. And
mm-hmm.
I was forced on them in a sense too. So, but I guess that's.
In general, how do you feel about your work experience at CUNA?
I think it's what made me who I am. It was my character building, and. I went on to do things which I never would have thought I would have done. They just came organically out of the struggle and working with other people. So I have very negative feelings about the institution and what it did to people ultimately and how I was treated by many people. But I learned so much about being a human
mm-hmm.
And the struggles. And
mm-hmm.
yeah, it was just... what I've always said to people, I went into a field of landscape and plants, but it's never been about that. It's always been about people. And what's still true today is that the way people look at a landscape is just who they are as people. And so the diversity of views is incredible, and that's what makes it so hard even for what we're doing today. Because every time I take a management act, I'm taking an action in response to some particular view of landscape.
Mm-hmm.
And there's so many views out there that it's always violating somebody's illusion perception.
Mm-hmm. I think what I kind of hope to do here is finish our discussion on CUNA,
mm-hmm.
and then I know there's another position in here that I want to talk a little bit more about the Midwest Land and Culture,
mm-hmm.
The business that you were involved in. And then maybe for our next discussion,
mm-hmm.
we'll really focus on your university experience.
Okay.
One thing that you mentioned earlier about your experience at CUNA was the struggle that there was, or this resistance towards natural wildlife. Natural prairie development and some of the backlash from the public. Could you speak a little bit more about that, what you experienced and in what ways?
Yes, I think nobody had done this before. It was basically one of the first projects around to ever put in natural landscaping. And because it was an insurance company, people thought we weren't mowing the lawn. And an insurance company that doesn't mow the lawn and has dandelions, it clearly speaks against the credibility of the insurance company if they don't know how to maintain their property.
Mm.
And so this caused a lot of problem because nobody knew how to do prairie restoration either. So we couldn't promise them when the weeds would go away. Everything was an experiment. And then we had fire around the building. But I remember clearly people from McKay's and other companies stopping by to yell and fight with me about what I was doing, destroying Madison's landscape, Madison's image, with what I was doing. And our irrigation system was sabotaged at one point, and I really thought that it was probably a landscape company that had sabotaged it. So I was put on a committee for the Common Council to fight for the natural landscape ordinance or to write one. It was, we joked, they put short grass people and long grass people on the committee and came out with this new ordinance to pass where you could apply for a natural landscape, and it was part of our education of people about how to help the environment and what it did for the environment.
Mm-hmm.
But there were people who just, they could never stomach the idea of not having just a beautiful mowed lawn
mm-hmm.
on the front of the insurance company. And there were others who just loved it. And so there was quite a division within the company.
Mm-hmm.
I really helped to have school children out there and to really show that it was a, and then the Time Life people came and interviewed and put us in their gardening book. So that kind of credentials helped. But then when I moved on to a school site nearby, John Muir Woodlands of all, or John Muir School, as part of a National Science Foundation grant out of Edgewood College, I was school teachers in Madison. We were working on how you could get natural areas for children in their backyards to use for school site.
Mm-hmm.
Instead of having to go to some big place someplace, you could use your backyard. And so the idea was to start little backyards on school sites. And John Muir School was just a naked site with some spruce trees on it. So I was working with the first grade teacher, and we were, and I designed a landscape for the John Muir School, and we were implementing it with the neighborhood. And one of the vice presidents of the company lived in the neighborhood, and he was just furious. So he did all he could to destroy me, and that's how the job was, the whole prairie and work with the schools was eliminated.
Mm-hmm.
Because the idea of having a prairie in his neighborhood was just too much to take, and he was just too humiliated for being part of a company that would allow that to go on. So that was, there were parents who were afraid of the vermin in the grass. Their children would be damaged by the, something in the tall grass. These are people who had grown up in neighborhoods that didn't have tall grass. So it was passing on whatever you had as a parent, passing on your fears and phobias to the children, which is, of course, what we were trying to overcome, is give children a comfort being in nature. So, but Madison wasn't ready for it. I mean, now they're the only ones that don't have a prairie, and the university prairie on the land across the
mm-hmm.
road that used to belong to them, that's all prairie. So, but it was just early, and people didn't know what to make of it.
Mm-hmm. And how in what way was your job essentially liquidated, I guess you could say? How did that happen?
There were a couple phases to it. That one was the prairie was stopped and plowed under because of that vice president after the first one had retired. And then I was relegated to taking care of atriums and things. But there was no landscape program that had replaced it. So I ultimately got permission from the president of the company to start a landscape department out there that would actually put landscaping back in. And I was, that vice president was ordered not to have any contact with me because of things he'd been overheard saying of a violent nature. Violent sexual nature about me. And so then I had a landscape unit. And then when the supervisor of the grounds department at that time, because the one I had really liked had to retire from illness, needed to be taken out of his position for something he had done, I was put over both units and merged the two, and then went on to form that department. And then managed the grounds department from then on, and some other property management things. But then in 1995, after the company had merged with a company in Iowa, and that was led by Dick Hines of the business school here, who was on the board and was also president then of CUNA Mutual,
mm-hmm.
They decided that they would try outsourcing all maintenance of the facility, inside, outside, all of it. And so that's when I actually lost my position entirely, along with all the other facility management people
mm-hmm.
at CUNA Mutual.
And how did you feel after that? I
it was
imagine.
Devastating because I had, I was the, because of my condition of my husband, I'm the breadwinner and the provider of benefits, and I've been with the company for 23 years. And just to have everything gone in a day, when I had customized my life to that. And it was a time when companies don't, Ken Mitchell never got rid of anybody, and it was before all the corporate stuff that's so common now happened. And the idea of staying with a company all that time and giving your life to that company and then just being gone. And because in my own family, fallibility. I had not chosen a profession. I had chosen to do a work, and that's where my work was. I didn't see anywhere to go. And so it was devastating. What do you do now? It was like 47, 48. Yeah. It was time to start a new career. So it was a pretty devastating experience.
And for your family, I mean, how did that?
Also devastating for my husband. I think my parents just didn't understand it.
Mm-hmm.
You know, this was just, nobody could understand those kinds of things.
Mm-hmm.
And now it's just so commonplace that corporations do things like that. But Kina Mitchell had stood for like the co-op movement, the progressive movement, the credit unions.
Mm-hmm.
And they had really entirely changed their nature. And so that was really hard to, the previous presidents never would have done anything like that. There were two presidents before that, and they never would have done anything like that. It was a company, you take care of your own kind of thing, a real co-op feeling, it's membership, we're all together.
Mm-hmm.
And it had changed to an entirely different American corporation, and given up its values, is what I think most people would say.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
And during this time period, so you're working at CUNA, is that around the same time that you start Midwest Land?
I started Midwest Land in Culture as part of what to do after CUNA Mutual. So I had come out, it was a very difficult time at CUNA Mutual too because of actual lawsuits over sexual discrimination that I didn't do, but I had hired a woman who then, because of all of the treatment of us, she turned around and sued the company, and because I was part of management, it was all quite a mess. And a lot of violent innuendo going on. I was actually not safe for a while there.
Mm-hmm.
So Midwest Land and Culture was something that I started on as a way to sort of build a new life while I tried to figure out what else to do while I also got jobs. I got a job working for Glenn Stanos here, in the forestry department for a summer. But Midwest Land and Culture was with somebody who was just very akin to my belief system and my
mm-hmm.
commitments. We're very similar,
mm-hmm.
similar in what we stood for and how we looked at the world. So that's how we got together. And I was coming more from the landscape management side, and she was coming from, she does oral history of people's relationships to the land. She's done oral history of the people who live on the Rock River.
Okay.
Things like that, yeah. So that was her perspective, was the cultural landscape part.
Mm-hmm. And what kind of work did the two of you do?
Well, she was finishing an oral history. We applied for two grants. We got one grant where I did a landscape forestry management plan for Vilas for the zoo, which they did not follow. I did it, but they were into so many other kinds of building projects that overrode it that they didn't actually, I mean, it was nice for them, but it wasn't something that they really followed as a plan. And then we also got a DNR grant for Brewery Creek in Mineral Point, and she worked primarily on that one, and the history of Mineral Point, and one of those things for sort of Main Street revitalization and cultural landscape. But I really needed more than that, and I needed benefits and all of that, so I needed to take the university thing as soon as I could.
Mm-hmm.
So I was doing both for a while, but then as soon as I could make this into a going venture, I needed to drop that.
Mm-hmm.
And she now has Midwest Land and Culture, was still going with Jerry.
Oh, great.
Yeah, yeah. And she's been working a lot with the city of Milwaukee.
Mm-hmm. And do you still maintain some sort of relationship with her?
We haven't, just because I've been so overwhelmed by this. We've kind of gone our... I would like to get together with her some more. And she's been finishing a doctorate, and she'd started doing a lot of stuff with Urban Open Space Foundation also. She sort of continued her thing and I was doing mine. Both of us are so overwhelmed by our separate worlds that we haven't kept together very much.
Mm-hmm.
But
well, we've kind of come up to, I think, the time period, at least as far as I
mm-hmm.
understand it, about the 1996-97 time frame.
Mm-hmm.
So I think maybe for today that's a good place to stop. But
mm-hmm.
is there anything else looking back on what we've already discussed?
Are you getting what you had anticipated out of this?
Mm-hmm.
I mean, is this helping?
Mm-hmm.
Is this helping? I think when we meet again, one of the things I want to just be able to mention is to refer to some of the people who helped me at the university in those early years and what gave me, I think that's part of answering your question about what gave me the strength, what gave me that belief system, what individuals in my coursework, faculty or whatever inspired me to do these things, to know that it was worth it. And then just as a note before we go on, to say that in retrospect, one of the things that's interesting to me is how totally unprepared I was for the shock of trying to make it in that world as a woman. It seems sort of peculiar now and naive that I was so unprepared, and that there's nobody on campus who ever even talked about the role of women in the industry. It was just not something that was out there. So
mm-hmm.
that's something I think we
definitely. Well, thank you.
Thank you.